The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this June 16th, 2012 version of Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn Yeager. My guest today is someone with a lot of knowledge about and experience in not just the white advocacy history and personalities of the past 50 or more years, but the background of our present troubles, which can be found in the 20th century wars that took place on European soil, and then again also the power politics as it's played out today. Now, before I say hello to Hadding Scott, I want to tell you that because I am using some new software for today's program, I don't want to take a chance on taking Skype calls during the show. And let me tell you, this software, today I'm using a new, and not a new so much, but kind of new and improved version, and it's really great. It's just wonderful. I'm thrilled with how Tanstoffel has set this up for our network. It's just wonderful. Anyway, everything should go very smoothly today, but I don't want to take calls on Skype, and I think people have a little trouble figuring out how to do that. Anyway, we don't have telephone lines yet, but if you have a question for Hadding, please email it to me at carolyn@carolynyeager.com, okay? My email that I will be checking every so often, excuse me, is simply carolyn@carolynyeager.com. So you can write something there if you want, but keep it kind of short if you can, because we don't have commercial breaks at the White Network in which I can read messages that are coming in, except at the top of the hour, at the mid-show break. So I'll be looking at my email account then, and also maybe a couple of times before that and after. So now on to my guest. Welcome, Hadding Scott, and thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. I hope I can live up to the introduction.
Well, I know you can, because as I was going to say, you've been a caller to my Heretics Hour program when it was on Voice of Reason, and I always enjoyed having you on with me. You're very easy to be with, and you didn't get much of a chance to talk very often. I mean, I was always talking, and you were very nicely staying silent while I went on and on. But you're always ready to add anything. So I'm glad now that you're going to be able to talk a lot. I seem to have something in my throat. I'm very sorry. Excuse me. All right, that's better. I didn't know of all of your accomplishments at that time. I knew of you as a writer at forums and a few other things. But since then, I've learned about your websites and a lot of things that you've done. And this is what we're going to discuss today. We're going to go through each of those things, and that will take us into a lot of interesting talk, I think. So I'd like to start out with how you came to be an advocate for the white race and for historical revisionism. I think it's an interesting story, and I know that people love to hear how others came to join into the same politically incorrect path that they did. You know, I find your story very interesting, and I'm sure the listeners would too. So take your time with it. About how it all came about for you.
All right. Well, first place, I grew up in the South. My mother was a woman of Southern heritage. My father of German extraction. And my mother, I recall, when I was in elementary school, she got very agitated one day because of things I'd learned in school about Abraham Lincoln. And because she knew that there was another side to the story, and she let me know that there was another side. So I had, from a very early age, exposure to the idea that the mainstream history sometimes isn't quite right. And one of my favorite sayings that my mother used to repeat was, don't believe everything that you hear, or don't believe everything that people tell you. So that was a pretty important foundation right there. My father, although he was of German extraction and very proud of being ethnically German, or the part of him that was ethnically German since his mother was English, he did not approve of Adolf Hitler whatsoever. So there was a kind of dichotomy there in his attitudes. When I got into my teens and I started trying to figure out the world for myself, and trying to think for myself, I adopted the libertarian ideology. Libertarianism has the appeal for a young person of being simple and also based on some traditional principles, things that we're all taught, you know, the value of individual freedom. America, the land of freedom, right? Libertarianism just carries that to the extreme, really.
Yes.
But it also provides a way to justify, to a limited degree, evasion of some of the things that the federal government wants to do in terms of forcing racial integration and things like that. So it has a certain amount of appeal to somebody that has racial views. And my parents both had racial views. Now,
that's interesting.
Yeah, they did. Of course. I mean, I used to think everybody did. Some people don't. But
well, that's true. You know, my parents certainly did. It wasn't something that they preached, but it just came out all the time. I mean, and you're right. I mean, that was, I go back far enough that that's the way people saw things. And although already it wasn't something you would say out in public, you wouldn't say it in public, but you certainly said it, you know, just talked about things in, you know, how in that way when you're at home. I mean, if it came up, it didn't come up that much in my home, but go ahead.
I could tell you some stories. My father one time was, after my parents divorced, he was repairing a light out on my mother's front porch. And my mother said, "Why's the dog barking?" And my father said really loudly, my father said, "Oh, it's just a nigger walking down the street." And this black guy walking down the street, I saw him straighten up. But he just kept going, you know. It's like he was shocked.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of thing, though, that caused Negroes to have a good case for themselves. Because anybody would hear that and they'd say, well, that wasn't nice. And it's too bad that Negro man had to hear something like that. That can't make you feel very good, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, I saw an interview. I remember when I saw Scatman Crothers, the interview with Tom Snyder on the Tomorrow Show. And Scatman Crother said, you know, the word nigger, it used to be just the word that everybody used. It didn't have a particular pejorative quality to it. It was just the word that everybody used. And my father grew up when that was the case. And he never changed. But,
yes. Yeah,
getting back to libertarianism, It's an appealing ideology for somebody trying to make sense out of the world because it's simple. Over the course of time, I found out that things weren't quite that simple. I found out that libertarianism is really wishful thinking because people don't behave, first of all, strictly according to the rule of law, which is one of the assumptions of libertarianism, is that people will respect the rules. In other words, it's not a might makes right world. That's an assumption of libertarianism. And another thing that libertarianism doesn't take account of is the fact that people behave according to interest groups and that they will use their collective force to make things go a certain way, and that individual pursuit of self-interest doesn't really have a chance against a powerful interest group.
That's true.
So this kind of individualism really leaves us weak and vulnerable to the extent that we insist on living that way. Leaves us, the white race, weak and vulnerable. We need to cooperate. We need to work together. Mm-hmm. This guy, Rob Freeman, what does he usually call himself? He calls himself by something else usually, but Rob Freeman.
Yeah, something man. Heavy man? No. Hardy man? Is that
anyway,
the guy? Salt
yeah,
man
he,
or
he
something?
Talks about, was it Mind Wars in Ragnarok is his blog? And he talks all the time about this, the fact that the white people need to work together. But you've got this individualist ideology, this libertarianism standing in the way.
Mm-hmm.
People think that's the way you should live.
Well, you know, I got interested in libertarianism, maybe around 2000 or something like that. You know, when everything in the government, you know, George Bush being elected and the whole thing, everything was so distressing and bad. And I read something, a pamphlet or something, and it all sounded so good, you know, and I thought, oh, that maybe that's the answer. And I flirted with that for a while, but it didn't take me long where I saw it just didn't answer things. And maybe the biggest thing was the immigration problem. I may have been aware of that. I must have been at that time. And so I gave up on that pretty quickly.
Yeah. And something else that opened my eyes was, something particularly that opened my eyes was when I saw the way that some people's individual rights were not respected. I saw a television interview of Matt Cale, who was at that time leader of New Order. He had been leader of National Socialist White People's Party. Name had been changed to New Order. And he was in this television interview with Martin Kaden, who at one time had been a writer for Victory at Sea. He was a Jew, but I didn't know that at the time. And Martin Kaden had announced the previous week that he was going to be interviewing this Nazi, Matt Cale. And I was fascinated that somebody could be a Nazi, and I wanted to learn about the thought processes of somebody that could take such an unusual path, which in terms of American assumptions seems completely inexplicable. In terms of what most people know and believe, it's impossible to understand. It's like,
yes.
I don't know, it's like being a vampire or something.
What,
how did you get to that?
What year was this? What year was this interview?
This was about 1984.
Wow, you know, you were catching on real early. I mean, you started out. You're what I would call an old timer in this movement. Are you?
Well,
I didn't
put everything together right away. That Matt Cale interview stuck in my head because Martin Kaden was extremely unfair to Matt Cale. I had tuned into this interview hoping to hear what Matt Cale would say, and to get his explanation of why he believes what he believes. And I didn't get to hear it because the interviewer wouldn't let him talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so angry and disappointed that I wrote a letter to the production company. I said, you made me feel sorry for that Nazi because you wouldn't let him talk. You just browbeat him the whole time.
Good. Good for you.
And so that stuck in my mind, you know, that that there was, if they were trying so hard, if somebody was so desperate not to let Matt Cale speak, what is it that Matt Cale or a Nazi, what do these people have to say that I can't be allowed to hear? There must be something, either that or they're just being very unreasonable.
Yes.
And I'd also noticed, there's another thing I noticed, I used to hear the Larry King late night radio show. And that was a bizarre experience. I don't know if how many people out there listening now ever heard Larry King when he had his late night radio show. I
not
have an
me.
Idea.
Not me. I didn't.
Not me. Well, yeah, I used to hear it, and it was bizarre because the guy promoted racial equality every night, and I'd never heard anybody do that. And he had callers that agreed with him on everything.
Hmm.
Now, I didn't know what planet could these people be from, but Larry King talked all the time about being a Jew. And he had guests all the time that were his buddies from back in the old neighborhood in New York City, and they were also Jews. And other people that he had on his show were Jews that he promoted. So he was using his radio show on Mutual Broadcasting System all the time to promote his Jewish buddies.
Did he do the same on his TV when he went on TV?
No.
I was very aware of him having this TV talk show, and I know I wasn't a regular watcher, viewer, but I did see it. And, in fact, there was a period of time when I saw quite a few of them. It wasn't all that long ago, maybe 8 years ago or something. And he, I don't recall him. I don't recall even knowing he was a Jew for a while. Did he start covering that up?
If you listen to his late night Mutual Broadcasting System radio show, you would know it because he talked about it all the time.
Yeah.
Talked about it all the time.
But I think he must have changed that a little bit when he went on TV.
I think, if he had a daytime radio show for a while in the 90s, and he was very different on that than he had been in the nighttime. I think somebody coached him on how to talk.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And then when he went on, CNN, I think there was a lot of restrictions on what he could do. He had some of his old Jewish buddies on, like Matthew Lesko.
Mm-hmm. I thought he was, when I found out he was a Jew and all of that, and I could see some of his, how he was dealing with things, I thought that he was trying to cover it up. I thought he was trying to, not for people not to think of him or see him as a Jew, just see him as a regular personality. But I don't know. Anyway,
on CNN, that probably was the case. But no, he didn't.
Right.
And let's see. So yeah. So I another thing. I'm rambling here.
No, you're doing good.
Another thing was the Ernst Zundel trial.
Yes.
I heard about that in the late 1980s, and that was very interesting to me. It reminded me of what I'd seen previously about the treatment of Matt Cale, about how he wasn't allowed to speak and explain himself. And I didn't have any opinion about the Holocaust at the time. I assumed it was all true. But there were enough points made that I found out from listening to Radio Free America with Tom Valentine on the old Sun Radio Network. There were enough points made to make me realize that there was at least something wrong with the story. There was at least some exaggeration.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm getting away from being somebody with mainstream political thinking with these insights that are just as a result of reacting to things that I'm seeing in the media, in the mainstream media. I'm realizing that certain viewpoints are not allowed to be expressed. I'm realizing that Jews are very prominent in the media, or at least where they are. They use their positions to promote Jewish interests, as well as their personal interests.
Did you get anti-Jewish feelings or from your parents when you were young, as you did with anti-Negro?
No. My mother was definitely not anti-Jewish at all. She had that traditional Southern Judeophilia.
Oh.
That MacDonald has mentioned. My father had kind of, he wasn't really anti-Jew, but he would say some nasty things about certain Jews sometimes, like Barbara Walters. He said, "Look at that Jew bitch, she's hung over again," on the Today Show.
Yeah,
he thought she was hung over from partying the night before. But in general, he didn't really have a problem with Jews.
Okay. So, but you are learning that on your own.
Well, I was realizing that there were pieces of important information that were kept from us.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. I started to be curious about these things. All these questions that we weren't supposed to ask, I started wondering, why are we not allowed to ask that?
Good.
Shortly after I learned about Zundel, or around the same time, I saw John Metzger, the son of Tom Metzger, on that Larry King CNN show. And I understood everything that John Metzger said, except when he talked about Jews. It's like I agreed with everything he said up to that point, because he talked about blacks. Blacks are inferior. Okay, yes, I understand that. Everybody knows that. And then he talked about Jews. I said, what? So I wrote to them, and they wrote back to me, and I argued with them a little bit. And so I had to keep thinking about that.
You wrote to Tom Metzger.
I did. Uh-huh. And they wrote back to me. And I argued with them at first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, first, you know, you don't accept something like that.
Oh, no.
Without questioning.
Right, right.
You know, so.
So then you said you started reading old books. What were these old books? Because you wanted to, you saw that the state of society was something wrong with it. And
yes.
You weren't getting the truth, and so you started reading old books.
Yes. Well, what had happened was I had taken some courses, or I'd been a student, actually, at a community college and participated in student government, things like this. And the way people behaved was so repulsive and so crooked, just in this student government thing, you know, where nothing was really at stake.
And politics, you mean the politics was really fierce, huh?
And this, you know, I had this friend that was on the faculty there, and I talked to him about it. He said, oh, it's always like this everywhere. It's always been like this. And I just didn't believe that. I thought if people had always acted like this in politics, we couldn't have survived this long. Well, it was a lot more than just the student government thing. It was also that the president of the university was supposedly in bed with some construction contractor, things like this. Mm-hmm. There were, all this kind of stuff was just accepted as normal.
Yes,
and
it is.
It appalled me and shocked me. You know, you're supposed to learn, you know, the idealism of the, what do you call it, rule by law, and, you know, everybody behaves according to the rules of order and stuff like that. I learned the opposite. I learned that that's not how it works.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that people only enforce rules and only employ rules to the extent that they find it to be in their interest.
And so you, instead of learning to go along with that like most people do, or ignoring it or whatever, it bothered you so much.
I recoiled from it, and because I was sure that things must have been different. See, one thing that affected me is the fact that my parents were a lot older than most parents of people my age. My parents were both around 40 years old when I was born.
Okay.
So they were from... You know, my upbringing was from a couple of generations earlier.
Okay.
You know, my father was born in, well, he was born in the 1920s. And so.
Okay. So you studied, you started to,
I'm a throwback
Greek and Latin,
culturally.
Is it?
I did. Yes, I started out just reading old books. First thing that influenced me a lot was I got a book of old essays for college freshmen to read. I found this in a secondhand store for a quarter or something like that. It was essays for freshmen. And one of the essays was The Prospects of Popular Government by Henry Sumner Maine. Henry Sumner Maine was... an Englishman of the late 19th century that argued that popular government was a very flawed institution. That was the first time I'd been exposed to that idea. He said that the people that really run things are the wire pullers. In other words, what he was saying, writing in the late 19th century already, is that it's the mass media that really controls everything, not the people, because the people have to rely on the mass media for their information.
That's right. And who understood that best but the Jews, who knew that that's what they needed to take over in every country they were in, particularly when in modern times when there was a real mass media, a real media. So they went about doing that. Right?
Yes, they understood where the power was, and they went for it. If you read some of the ancient Greek orators, they know that the orators had a lot of power. The orators in Athens were the mass media of the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good.
Another essay that I read that just happened to come upon was Sweetness and Light by Matthew Arnold. Matthew Arnold, he wrote a book called Culture and Anarchy, and this was really just a chapter from that book. And his argument was that we should not be subordinating ourselves to the mechanics of society. We should not be making ourselves into machinery for other people to use. We should be cognizant of values. We should be trying to make good prevail in the world, you know, whatever that might be. So you have to think about that. What is good? What am I really for? What do I want to see prevail? I mean, if you're thinking that way, then you're already not an economic man. You're already not playing the game of just trying to make as much money like everybody else.
Yes.
Which is pretty much the American ideal.
Yes, yeah. So then you wrote a book by R.D. Lang, The Politics of Experience.
That's right. Politics of Experience, R.D. Lang. And I could have read the same thing in some of his other books. R.D. Lang was a Scottish psychiatrist. I read him for a book report for a general psychology class because the cover of the book looked interesting. And R.D. Lang's general view is that, well, what he wrote about particularly was schizophrenia. And his theory was that the families of schizophrenics made them crazy. And that may be an excessive theory. He may have gone too far with that because, I mean, I think there is a biological basis for it. But the part of his observation that's important is that very often the seemingly paranoid statements that the schizophrenics would make about their families, like, my father is trying to poison me, that in some way there was a kind of poetic truth in the statement. The father harbored ill will. The father was doing things that sabotaged this person's life in some way, in some subtle way. And so he also found that that the other members of the family tended to make that one person into the scapegoat for everything that went wrong in the family. And I took this idea about how a group of people can have a distorted view about who is responsible for all the problems and make one person the scapegoat. And I thought about how is that applicable to history? And, well, another thing I forgot to mention is it's R.D. Lang was basically arguing that the supposedly crazy person was not really crazy, just demonized by the other people in the family. So I started to think about Hitler that way. Because he's the ultimate demon. Started to ask the questions, is he really that demon? Is he really that crazy man? Because there's so many stories about him that just on their face seem hard to believe. You can't understand how a human being could make such decisions. And people ought to ask themselves, how, you know, do I really believe this? Why do I believe this? Could this perhaps not be true? People ought to have a little skepticism about these fantastic stories.
But they don't because they want to have a scapegoat, huh?
Yes. That's exactly right. Well, many of the things that that have been laid, many of the accusations have been laid at the feet of Adolf Hitler and of Germany are accusations that really belong with the accusers. You know the story about the Germans supposedly cutting off the hands of Belgian children in World War One.
Yes.
Do you know who was cutting hands off of children?
Well, let's see. Who would be the ones who told the story?
It wasn't in the First World War. It was before the First World War in the Belgian Congo.
Oh, the Belgians in the Congo.
Congo Free State, I think it was at that time.
That's interesting.
They were cutting hands off of people down there.
Who was doing that? The Belgians were doing it, or the
I can't give you a good account of it right now off the top of my head. But okay. If you do a little search on Congo Free State, I think it's probably on Wikipedia.
They had
problems with the natives, and the way they dealt with it was to send people out to chop off hands, because that was the way to prove that you'd killed the person supposedly. But a lot of times they just chopped off the hand and didn't kill them.
Well, you know, during World War II, in the East, the Eastern Campaign, they also mutilated the German soldiers so badly, you know, left them not only dead but mutilated. Is that also some kind of a thing that goes on with people? Would you compare that in any way to what you're saying about that they cut the hands off the...
Well, no, that thing with cutting the hands off, that was like bringing back an ear to prove that the person was killed. That's what it was about.
Oh, to prove that they were killed. Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. Although they weren't always.
Yeah.
There were a lot of blacks in the Congo walking around with one hand.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's some other accusations that really, like the accusation about the... Well, I mean, basically the accusation against the German treatment of the Jews is kind of a caricature of what a lot of Americans would have liked to have done with the blacks here. A lot of Americans would have liked to have rounded up the blacks and shipped them out or do something with them. Mm-hmm. Just get them out of here. And this thing with the Jews was a kind of a projection of that, except they made the, you know, people saw the Jews as being white people more or less. So it seemed a lot harder to tolerate. And also people tended to think that this thing about the Jews was like the one drop rule in the United States, where, you know, in the United States, if you had one drop of Negro blood, you know, just one Negro ancestor, you were not white by law. Mm-hmm. Which meant that you had to go to the non-white school and so forth. And people have tended to assume that this is how it was in Germany with the Jews, that if you had one Jewish ancestor. No.
Yeah.
It was not like that at all.
That's right.
It was much looser than that. If you had less than two Jewish grandparents, you were not a Jew.
If you had one Jewish grandparent, you could be, if you had just one Jewish grandparent of your four grandparents, you could be included among the Germans, right?
If I remember correctly, one Jewish grandparent is a Michelin of the first degree.
Okay, there you go. That's right. They had the Michelin category.
Yeah.
But that was a Michelin was different from a Jew, right? I mean,
yes.
Yeah, those were different categories, so Michelin was kind of in between.
I don't think a Michelin could. I don't think a Michelin was eligible for citizenship, except maybe if they. See, I don't know the details of the law really, but they were interested in shipping Jews out, but
yes.
Michelins they didn't ship out.
Okay.
Yeah. And somebody will say something if I got that wrong.
Yeah.
But
most people are confused about it. So I don't know that they would.
Yeah, so this whole thing about viewing Hitler as the monster, I mean, rational people ought to, educated people even, all educated people, all really educated people ought to question something like that on its face.
Mm-hmm.
On its face.
Well, you know, I questioned it. I kind of questioned it, but I didn't go all out. But I'll tell you just real quick, when I was a teenager, and I don't know exactly what age I was, but we got magazines in the house, and I was looking at a latest magazine maybe look or something like that. I don't think it was life. This goes back. And there was and of course I knew I was German, and I knew basically about the war and so on. But there was this big article in there about Hitler and how Hitler had mesmerized the German people, and how the German people had been kind of hypnotized and followed him. And they had a big picture of Hitler's face with his, you know, looking all distorted, his mouth open, yes, and so on. And then they had a picture of all these people at one of those torchlight rallies, you know, where he spoke, and all these people came and looking like a bunch of robots or something, standing out there with their faces up and the lights shining on them, you know, like they were being looking at the second coming or something. And so then they gave this had this story about it, and I was so you know, I was standing there looking at this magazine for a long time at this picture, because I thought that Hitler was not at all attractive, and with that funny mustache, and I couldn't imagine why anybody would like him or would follow him or would think he was, you know, anything great. But still, I didn't understand why the German people would do that. It didn't make sense to me that they were just like hypnotized or something. And I grew up with Germans. I had all Germans in my family. I knew German people. And that sticks in my mind even today. You know, there are certain things that stay in your mind that happened to you. I have one even from kindergarten and some from earlier than that, that were real turning points, kind of, where something really happened and I stayed with me. And that's one of them. It depressed me a little bit. Oh, I shouldn't say depressed, but I didn't like it that the German people had this terrible reputation, you know, that they were demonized like that. And I didn't like it, but there was nothing I could do with it. And I suppose in that moment I was trying to understand something too.
Yeah, you know what? Stories about Nazi Germany, I think, are the new ghost stories.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're spooky stories. People get all goosebumpy, and so it's like, ooh, that's a scary story.
Oh yeah, it's horrible. You know, now here I'm going to start again. At the same period of time in my life, well, very early teenage years, we had slumber parties, and what got going at these slumber parties was some of us was telling a lot of what started out with ghost stories, and then it was even more gruesome things, any gruesome thing you could think of. Well, I had a few of them that I had been told by cousins and stuff, you know, about worms eating dead bodies and a few other things, you know, that some people didn't want to listen to. But we would, you know, it was, the idea was, how gruesome of a story can you tell? And it was a big, I wouldn't call it, it wasn't a turn on, but it was something that we wanted to do because, oh, give us all the shit. Oh, isn't it? And things that you can't believe would really happen. That's really it. It doesn't fit in our normal life. And that's the Holocaust stories. They don't fit into what people know about human beings. And yet they want to believe that these Nazis were just couldn't be cruel and sadistic enough, you know, to Jews or even to others. Go ahead.
The interesting thing is, if you start from the assumption that the Germans are people just like us,
yes,
that forces you. If you accept the Jews' story that the Germans wanted to kill all of them, then you have to ask, what did the Jews do to bring that on themselves?
Well, that's it. That's the question that people don't go to.
That's the ultimate implication of the Holocaust story. I think some Jews might realize that.
They must. Of course they do. And they try to steer everybody away from that all the time, from coming to that realization, ever saying that. That's where the anti-Semite comes in. If you talk about the faults of the Jews in history and things they've done, oh, that's anti-Semitic. And people are moved by that. Well, you know, I've talked before on this show about how how people are so moved by that. So we'll just take that as a truism and go on with your story, because you say then you were an activist on your own for a while before you joined the National Alliance in the early 1990s. That was early. You were an early bird. And what do you mean by activist? You're an activist. What kind of activism did you do? Because I ask that because, you know, we've got so many people, people who listen to my programs and people who are maybe activists on the internet, but there's not very many who are really activists out in the world, and I fault myself for that too. So what were you doing? What are you?
Well, when I realized that there was this taboo against asking questions about the Jewish role in history and things like this, asking if maybe some of the stories of conspiracy theories and some of the stereotypes, maybe there was some truth in there somewhere. When I realized that this was taboo, I had to ask that because I believed in freedom of speech. I wanted to try out my freedom of speech to find out if I really had some.
Okay, and good for you.
I was accepted at an elite college where there were lots of Jews. Mm-hmm. And I was constantly involved in discussions with people in classes, in the cafeteria, all over the place, constantly involved in discussions with people about these taboo questions.
And you were just a college student.
Yeah.
Good for you.
It was a big controversy around me. One person can stir up a lot of stuff just by asking questions. You got to have a thick skin, though.
Yes. Yes, you have to be one of those brave ones.
I ended up not staying in that particular college because there was a lot of trouble. But I went to a state university after that. And I hadn't joined the National Alliance yet, but I went to a state university and I didn't start up with the question asking as soon as I got there. I would recommend that if anybody wants to be a racial activist at a university, don't start it when you first arrive.
Okay.
Don't do anything like that your first year. Wait until some of the faculty, some of the professors know you and know that you're not a dangerous person. That way, if you get dragged in front of a student disciplinary committee, they'll say something nice about you. That's my experience anyway.
Okay. That's good advice, I'm sure.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I did do some things at this university, too, but I was a little more cautious about it. I posted bills on telephone poles, well, power poles, actually, around the campus. I hung a Confederate flag in my dorm window, which elicited cheers when I did that. There were cheers. This was like a 10-story dormitory building. And there was a lot of feeling of oppression among some of the students there. This is in a Southern state university, and a lot of people were kind of tacitly, you know, very conservative, somewhat racial. But, you know, they know you can't talk about these things and so forth. But there was this kind of liberal oppression. I knew one kid that was a student they'd given him a homosexual roommate. And this kid was afraid to complain about it. He was afraid to say, I don't want a homosexual roommate.
Mm-hmm.
So I hung this Confederate flag in my window and people cheered.
Okay.
And I had all kinds of trouble and harassment from it. None of it was really serious. None of it was really serious. You know, for example, people would shout things out of windows. And then they'd ask me if I was the one that shouted it. No, I didn't know. I hadn't had nothing to do with it. I got my flag that says everything I need to say. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, did you attract some friends to you who were willing to do any of this or stand behind you or anything? Or were they just cheering when you did it but not really participating?
I'm kind of a loner anyway. There were some people that said that they liked what I did. You know, I probably could have been their friends if I'd been interested in that.
Yeah.
You know, but anyway, I was doing that around the same time that I joined the National Alliance.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask you. So you joined the National Alliance. You were still in college.
Yes.
Okay. And you met William Pierce and.
Yes, I did.
Spoke with him, and that made what kind of impression on you did that make?
Dr. Pierce. That's interesting. I heard him on the radio before I ever met him in person. I used to listen to him on my shortwave radio while I was at the university. And he was the first person that I heard that said things the way I said things. He put racism in rational terms, based on science, based on demonstrable facts. You know, none of this, beer influenced bellowing. It was all rational and respectable, which is the way it ought to be.
Okay.
So I was motivated to join because this is a guy that talked the way I thought it should be done. In person, he was kind of hard to connect with, really. He was always a bit distant.
All right. Well, like you, a loner. No, I don't know.
Oh yeah, definitely he was.
Okay.
Definitely.
Well, you're not hard to connect with, it doesn't seem, but I've never met him. Well, let's go on.
I used to imitate Dr. Pierce's speech, the way he talked.
God, it's pretty good.
Damn it. God damn son of a bitch. He used to say that all the time.
Oh, did he?
Yep,
but not on his radio program.
He heard me imitating him say that, and he had to stop saying it because he heard me imitate him. Forced him to change his expletive to something else.
Oh, I hope it was a little bit better, not worse.
No, it was worse.
Oh.
I won't tell you what he changed it to.
Well, one of your websites now is the legacy of William Luther Pierce. So you must have a very good opinion of him.
Yes.
And you must have had a good opinion of him then, in spite of his.
Yeah.
It's,
doctrinally, everybody... for the most part, he's pretty sound. There's one difference I think I have with Dr. Pierce, and it's on economics. Dr. Pierce was not really a national socialist in terms of economics. This is something Rocky Suheda says as a reproach, and I think he's technically correct that Dr. Pierce had basically the capitalist outlook on economics.
Oh, did he never maybe study the National Socialist economics, or he just
not
didn't?
Sure. He pretty much believed in capitalist economics, you know, and kind of the social Darwinist economic outlook, which I think is wrong. But pretty much everything he says is pretty solid. There are a few things here and there, a few little things where I think he went a little overboard, but just small things. For the most part, I think he was the best spokesman that the racial cause of the United States ever had.
Yeah, he's as an American for the United States.
Well, right?
True.
And the United States. He was the best spokesman we ever had, and he was also a very good influence far beyond the range of the National Alliance itself, because he would tell people things in the bulletin about how they ought to behave. And a lot of those people that were members of the National Alliance did things like moderate on Stormfront, or they worked, you know, I think Alex Linder was a member for a while. And he would send out his view of things, and that had big reverberations. Also, the things that he said on his weekly radio show would end up being repeated by callers on, say, the Michael Reagan show. And then it would become a topic on those shows.
Ah.
So he had a huge influence, really. And I see things going, going downhill in the absence.
Well, I do too. We've had so many times when things were going very strong, and then it's like he got killed. And you can find some clues to some interference in, you know, for why that happened. I think you can in the Holocaust revisionist movement, which was going very strong in the 80s and then kind of got killed, and slowed way down. But I'm not sure. Besides, of course, Pierce died, and there just was, the people who were there to take over weren't of the same caliber, were they?
It's not just not being the same caliber. They also, it seems to me that most of the people around Dr. Pierce didn't understand the way he looked at things. They didn't understand the importance of quality over quantity. They all went in varying degrees for the big tent approach to activism, which was not Dr. Pierce's approach at all.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
Dr. Pierce believed in trying to appeal to the thinking people who know how to do things. You know, trying to appeal to the broad masses is
well, wouldn't that be something of his fault if he didn't teach the people under him to see things as he saw them, that he had all these assistants or lieutenants or whatever, and they didn't even understand or see things the same way. And so
you're right. He really didn't know how to run an organization. I'll put it that way. He was a great spokesman.
Well, he was a great thinker. I can just imagine him just wanting to spend his time working on his next speech or broadcast and thinking out all these problems. But he didn't so much like working with people, did he?
Yeah, there was. That's right. He was not very psychologically astute as far as judging individuals. I feel a little guilty saying anything negative about him, but I think that's accurate.
Well, now speaking of Adolf Hitler,
there was no ideological training, really, no formal ideological training for people that worked in the national office. Some of these people, they all went in varying degrees for the big tent approach right after Dr. Pierce died, which is exactly the opposite of what Dr. Pierce preached.
Did they understand that they were making a change, or did they?
Oh, yeah.
Did they believe that?
Oh yeah, like what's the guy's name? Oh, there was this one guy that wanted to change the membership handbook to soften Dr. Pierce's statements about Christianity.
Oh, there you go.
And Dr. Pierce was not, you know, foaming at the mouth, anti-Christian. He just thought basically what he said was that people are just nominal Christians. We can work with them, but it's these people that insist on taking Christianity extremely seriously, they're making Christianity into a problem. And
I think religion, the differences in that are the biggest problem that we have in the white movement. But just going back to who's going to follow you, Hitler was putting a lot of attention on that, but things, it all ended for him sooner than he wanted, but he was even at the end trying to get Rudel to be to take over after him. But he wasn't ready to do it. He veered away from even talking about that. So, but it's very hard. It's very hard if you have a real strong leader to, the big problem is what's going to happen after he's gone. And this often is what does us in, right? Well, while we're, before we're close to our top of the hour break, Hattie, and I should have given your websites at the beginning of the program, so let me do that now. And the next one, what we're going to talk about next, I think, is your National Socialist Worldview website, which is the first one that you set up, as far as I understand. I think it was in 2003.
And, yeah, the ones that I have now, it's the oldest one.
Okay. Yeah, it's at national-socialist-worldview.blogspot.com. It's really interesting, and I did not know about it until fairly recently. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff. There's something on there now. The current stories on there now are very interesting. And then you have non-counterproductive.blogspot.com, which is actually called Setting the Record Straight. And that one came next. It was more recent. But then the most recent one, I think, is the WilliamLutherPierce.blogspot.com.
That's right.
And then you have the other one, the German films, Wolken. You pronounce that properly.
Deutsche Wolkenschau.
Yeah. And it's got a lot. I just saw that the other day. It's got a whole lot of German newsreels from World War II. I watched the first one, but I haven't watched any of the others.
It's really just a collection of links that I put together, but it could be useful for somebody.
Yeah, very useful. I think it's great that it's there. All right, we have, we're almost going to our break, 30 seconds. And so, ladies and gentlemen, please stay with us for the next hour. And during this break, we're going to hear the same music that was played last week, but that's okay. It's very good. It's a Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau singing a German leader, Gutnacht, by Franz Schubert. And I hope you will relax and enjoy that. And we'll be back in about 5 minutes with my guest, Hadding Scott.
So gemacht von einem zu
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. That is such a beautiful piece of music. And once again, it is from Winterreise by Franz Schubert. And the it's a wonderful example of German Lieder, which is songs. I'll just say again, by Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau. Okay, my guest is Hadding Scott. I am Carolyn Yeager, and we are having a very nice conversation, I think, before the break, and certainly welcome you all back. And Hadding was telling us that about Dr. William Pierce, and and also we were saying that in 2003 he started his National Socialist Viewpoint website, started blogging, but also in
2008, I did National Socialist Worldview.
Oh, I don't know why I got that. You said you started blogging, and it was 2008 that you did the Worldview. Okay.
Yeah, I had another blog before that, but that's no longer around.
All right. Thank you for that correction. Okay. Now, but you in 2003, you did some writing of radio programs.
Yes, I did.
Pierce, right? Tell us about that.
Well, Dr. Pierce was gone. He died in 2002. National Alliance creaked along for a while pretty well without him, apparently. Billy Roper left to try to start his own organization using the big tent approach in the biggest way possible. My feeling was that we needed to pull together and try to keep what Dr. Pierce had started going. And so in late 2002, I started trying to write some American Dissident Voices programs.
Okay, let's make sure that the listeners know that these were a series of many years of radio programs, regularly broadcast, that were done by William Pierce mostly, and were like around a half hour in length each, and every one of them is just very good. There's some favorites people have, but
yeah, Kevin Strom actually invented the program, created the program, but Dr. Pierce, when it started around 1991, Dr. Pierce did about one a month himself, and Kevin Strom did the rest of them, but Dr. Pierce's were always the best. After Dr. Pierce died in early 2002, or mid 2002, it was. Kevin Strom came back and took it over again.
Mm-hmm. Kenneth Strom's work was never as hard-hitting as Dr. Pierce's. I felt there was something a little bit lacking. In particular, I was interested in the propaganda for war against Iraq. Kevin Strom, I'd heard him do one program about it, but it really wasn't very radical or incisive. It had kind of a conservative rhetoric. You know, conservatives use this rhetoric of trying to find hypocrisy in what the other side is saying, instead of doing some real digging and exposing new facts.
Yeah, talking about the other side is so much reaction. They think this is a real criticism that I have. You put it better than I do, I'm quite sure. But you know, I also don't. I think we should be going for a core group of people, and not lightening up our message for that reason. But also this idea that when I lost my train of thought, as I so often do. But what you had just been saying, that it's not, well, what were you saying? Go ahead.
I said that the conservative rhetoric is about nitpicking the other side's
reacting.
Position.
Yeah. And so I hear so many programs where people are just going over the news and reacting to what's on the news, and people like to hear that because it's like, oh yeah, tell it like it is, get them. But it's not really educating anyone. It's not getting us anywhere.
Yeah, you have to challenge the premises, the assumptions that the other side is putting out if there's anything wrong with them. You have to look at their assumptions because frequently their assumptions are wrong. All the information, almost all of it, if not all of it, that was being put out about Iraq and Saddam Hussein was false.
Mm-hmm.
Almost everything that was said about Saddam Hussein, which the average American probably still believes, was false. He was not a madman.
Right.
He did not start war against Iran for no reason. He did not gas Kurdish civilians. He did not invade Kuwait without reason. He was not poised to invade Saudi Arabia.
Right. You know, and at that time, before we went to war against Saddam Hussein, I was plugged into the Fox News when I was at my sports center on the treadmill, which I used to do a lot more than I do now. And so I took in all that news. And while I had not been really upset very much about 9/11, I thought, yeah, we need to do that. I actually was for, and I thought, well, I guess we need to go to war and get rid of that guy. And you know what it was? It was all these lies they told about his two sons. That's what got me the most.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that these sons of his were just out of control, going around arresting and putting people in prison, torturing people. And they had some pretty gory stories about what one of them did. And I thought, oh, that has to be stopped. We need to stop that. That's terrible. Well, you know, this was what makes me, helps me to be sympathetic to people who don't get it. Because times in my life when I didn't get it, and I think, you know, it's because I wasn't really paying that much attention. I was just taking the easy way, you know, responding to what was being said and saying and believing it and not even caring that much about, well, like when the war started, I was real sympathetic. I was real concerned about Americans dying. I didn't want any American soldiers to be hurt or die. But I didn't care about the rest of them, obviously, because, you know, I'm watching the bombing. And I didn't get to see the first Iraq war on TV, which I was, not in touch then. And so I thought, well, I missed seeing that war on TV that everybody was always talking about. And I really wasn't a warmonger at all. But, you know, now I had my chance to watch a war on TV. So I was watching it. I didn't watch it that much. I only watched it when I was at the sports center. But
oh, yeah, it was like watching a football game.
Yeah, but they're bombing us, all this night bombing. And it's like, okay, we got to get in there. We got to get that. Those people. We got to, you know, break down that government. We got to kill their, you know, break up their military. Yeah, well, you know, we do have to do that. And just insanity, you know, which I finally came to.
Oh yeah, but, I mean, and
Yeah, I mean, if anybody had just taken a little bit of trouble to look a little bit critically at the sources for some of the things that were being said, it was obvious there was nothing to it.
Yeah, maybe if I'd been listening to those programs in 2003 that you were writing, I would have had a different point of view. But I wasn't. So there you go, how important our media is. And so you didn't read any of those on the air. You just wrote them, right?
No, I wrote them and emailed them to Kevin Strom. For the most part, he didn't change very much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, good. So you were able to see all that. You took the time to learn about it. And
well, the information was, most of the information was out there just waiting to be found. You know, I saw John MacArthur, the publisher of Harper's Magazine, on Phil Donahue's show on MSNBC. And he talked about the fact that that the propaganda from the first war against Iraq had been exposed as false. The CIA had faked a satellite photograph showing an Iraqi troop buildup on the Saudi border. And that had been used to convince the Saudis to participate in the coalition against Iraq and to support the war against Iraq. And it was a deception because this woman, reporter Jean Heller, at the St. Petersburg Times, went and got a Russian satellite photo of the same site at the same time, and there were no troops there. So it was a lie. It was proven a lie already around 1992. But the thing is, people don't take note of these things. The lies get debunked, but they live on. Because the lie gets all kinds of publicity, and the debunk is just on page five.
And they know that, so they don't mind putting out these lies, knowing that they'll eventually be debunked, because they do have the power that they want them to have. So they don't care about being called liars.
You know, it's a big one that they still use is the Israeli bombing of the Iraqi nuclear facility in I think it was 1981. The Israelis sent some jets over to bomb a nuclear reactor at Osirak.
Yeah.
And the Israelis claimed that it was being used to make plutonium and that they were going to use it to make a nuclear weapon and that they had just, you know, nipped it in the bud. Otherwise, they had a mortal danger to their Israeli state. And people are still saying that. Michael Stavish still says that. But you know what? In 1983, the United Nations Security Council had a hearing on the whole thing, and the text of that, I found it online. The United States cast a vote to condemn Israel for bombing that reactor because there was no evidence. The evidence was all that there was nothing. None of that was going on there. The IAEA had been in there and inspected the place. There was no plutonium being made. There was no underground, there was no special chamber for it. None of that was true. The Israelis acted, they had bad intelligence. They bombed that lawful nuclear reactor without justification, and they got condemned for it in the United Nations. UN Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick cast a vote to condemn Israel.
Yeah, but were they made to pay to repair all the damage? Did they have to pay reparations? See, why is it that the Germans are always paying reparations for everything?
Not only did they not make reparations, they continue to claim what everybody ought to know is not true.
Well, that's true. They do. They continue their lies. That's why I say they don't care if they're called a liar. They don't care if they're known to be lying. They will still lie. They somehow their belief system includes that lying is an important part of their survival or something.
They seem to be geared towards social truth rather than the truth of dealing with physical reality. I think that has something to do with the fact that they've lived in cities a lot longer than Europeans have, and also the fact that they live a parasitic existence in the cities. They don't make things as a way to get their bread. They don't build things. Therefore, they're not, you know, saying something that people will believe is more important than actually telling the truth and knowing the truth.
Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah. Let me ask you this. So, what role did you play in the National Alliance after Dr. Pierce died? Were you very, active, or did you eventually move away, or what?
I thought we needed to make an effort to pull together and keep the thing going. And I wrote those programs. I wrote 8 altogether. I thought if we got several people with at least I couldn't turn out as good a script as Dr. Pierce every week, but I could turn out something pretty good maybe once or twice a month, you know. Mm-hmm. And I thought if we got several people involved instead of just having Kevin Strom do everything, then the quality could be raised. I thought Jerry Abbott could do some. He's a pretty smart guy, you know. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought. That's the kind of thing I thought needed to be done, but it didn't work out that way. I actually went up there to work. They actually hired me to work there in summer of 2003. But that didn't last very long because the whole thing fell apart right after I went away for a week. And by the time the week was over, Fred Streed had quit from the board of directors and it all had fallen to Eric Gleba by default. And they were threatening Kitty Moltz. And she was the last director that Dr. Pierce had appointed to the board of directors, and she was getting a lot of harassment, and she threw in the towel. So basically, they gave it up and let Gleba have it.
What was underneath all that? Was it just that people could not agree on anything?
No, I think the real problem there, this guy, I can't remember his name right now. He went to prison. And yeah, he actually became the director, so-called chairman of the National Alliance himself for a while. But,
he had a short name.
I don't remember his name at all, but I think he was the real conniver there or the real instigator of things. Eric Gleba, I think he was in over his head as chairman of the National Alliance.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way it appeared to me. I was at one meeting with him, and he looked like a deer in the headlights.
Yeah.
But I'm amazed that they've still kept it going. I really don't want any quarrel with Eric Gleba at this point because it won't solve anything. You know, I thought for a while there that somebody was going to do something about the situation, you know, legally.
Yeah.
I supported people that thought they were going to do, looked as if they were going to do something about it, and they never did anything. So, I don't want to argue about it anymore. I don't want to fight about it anymore. I got my own stuff that I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's
so I mean, basically the board of directors fumbled the ball. That's what happened. You know, then they let Eric Lee, and they fumbled the ball, and Eric Lieba picked it up and ran with it. And
well, that's the same thing that happened with the IHR. The board of directors just. I don't know. Didn't direct like it should have. But we might have time to get into that a little bit, or we might not. Now let's leave that. And so you started National Socialist website, National Socialist Worldview website in 2008. You say that's. I really like that website, and I wish I may have come across it, but there's so much to look at and follow and do that I don't get back to things and I forget them. So you say that you started your undernet channel, National Socialism. What does that mean?
Undernet is internet relay chat.
Undernet, it says. Oh, undernet.
Internet relay chat, and it's undernet is an internet relay chat server where you can chat with people live. It's just like chatting on Skype, except there's like. You know, maybe half a dozen or two dozen people in the channel, and any one of them might be saying something at any given time. It's like a Skype chat.
Okay, so, you know, you're always doing something. You're always, you know, trying to keep things going and doing something else. Now,
well, I thought, I think, I think discussion is important, and there are ways it helps you to get ideas clarified, and also to exchange information. I've got a pretty good group of people in my, I don't have very many people in my internet channel anymore. I used to have a lot of people in there, but half of them were crazy. You know, I only have a very few people now, but they're pretty good.
Okay, you know what? I've got a question. I've got something in the email, and this is a good time to bring it in before we move on. He says, please ask Catting why someone who purportedly is, I haven't even read this before I'm saying
it. Oh, this is going to be a nasty question.
Okay.
I tell already.
Oh, wait a minute.
Someone who is purportedly, yeah, this is
setting, is this about already. Setting the record straight? Okay, it might be someone from Appalachia, he says. Why someone who purportedly is on our side, does he mean you, would make such a serious, unsubstantiated claim like that about him, about who? Oh, Cass Sunstein. Oh, this is some old, this is some
Cass.
Old, Cass Sunstein, yeah. This is some old thing between you and some other people. We don't want to get into that.
Yeah, Harold Covington was calling me a Cass Sunstein cognitive dissonance operative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I know there's a lot of this stuff, so we'll pass on that.
It just makes me laugh when people take that stuff seriously. You know, people that are so stupid that they believe such things, those people don't count.
They don't count. That's exactly what this says, that you claim that, you know, Cass Sunstein is a cognitive dissonance operative. Okay. All right. Now,
yeah, that's what Harold Covington used to call me.
Yeah, well, it might be from him. I don't know who it is from. Oh, it says it's from Will Williams, but I don't think so, is it?
Well, Will Williams, he's in Appalachia, but he would be asking a friendly question, if anything.
Well, maybe this is friendly, and I'm not understanding it. Since we already, he says people should read your blog. Setting the record straight. Yeah.
Voila.
I may not understood this.
He wants to make sure that everybody reads the, you know, what my debunk of Harold Covington's lies, and there are
okay.
a lot of them.
Okay. Well, that's thanks, Will, and we will we'll talk about that setting the record straight in just a minute. Now, you say you've got so much here. It takes us a while to get through it. You learned from David Irving to go to primary sources. That made an impression on you.
Yes.
So you want to say anything about the importance of going to primary sources? I think
I heard your interview with Vincent Renoir,
yes,
from last week, and he talked about that also.
Yes, he did.
About looking at the old newspapers, and then you find out things that have gone down the memory hole.
Yes.
And
yeah.
This is a common thing. You get the David Irving. I saw him speak once, he talked about he actually had studied. I believe he said he had studied Latin and Greek himself. You know, you go back to those original sources to see what the original authors said, because a lot of times the way it's handed down is not exactly correct, or it's got some kind of twist on it, or they left something out.
Yeah, sometimes it's ignorance or mistakes, and sometimes it's on purpose.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And most people, in so many instances, I mean, even in English, where they think, you know, people aren't going to look this up, so I'll try to get this by, and they do, you know, for probably the majority, because most people don't check, even in their own language, let alone another language. This is misinformation. Misinformation and disinformation is a huge problem. But anyway, now let's go on to the National Socialist Doctrine. And you've said a lot of interesting things, but what would you like to say? What is your motive? You kind of got into this earlier, but what is your motive for writing about the Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich?
Well, I started out being interested primarily in truth. I want to live a real life. I want to be in touch with reality. I don't want to live a delusion.
Truth is usually more interesting anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to go along with a bunch of lies. I mean, but that just makes it possible to consider National Socialism. As far as actually embracing it, is because once you look at it, you start to see that it makes sense.
Yeah, see, there's this fear, you know, that, oh, you're trying to win people over to that evil thinking. Whereas, therefore, it's not possible for people to look at this subject matter objectively, like they might look at anything else and make up their mind. That's not allowed, because we already talked about the demonization. So you're trying to present it just as it was, not as anything perfect, and not as these dressed up type Nazis.
Those people.
I think that's great.
Those Hollywood Nazis, those people are, they're more interested in living out the lie that Hollywood has created. I mean, that's the way it seems to me, or exploiting that image, than in getting at the truth. What they're doing is not National Socialism. It's a costume, costume.
Yeah, and part. What you said, living out, that's really good. They want to be Nazis. They want an opportunity to be a Nazi. Well, you can't be a not very well. I mean, I'm not trying to be a Nazi. I'm very interested in it, but I'm not. I wouldn't call my, you know, I don't call myself that, because I'm not. And
no.
you can't be. And whatever might be created would not be a carbon copy of that. Although I think it's a great model to use.
Well, I make a great point of not using that word Nazi, except with quotation marks around it, because the National Socialists did not call themselves that.
Right. Yeah, the people had these kind of, they had the Nazis and they had the Sozis and
Goebbels wrote
terms.
A pamphlet called the Nazi Sozi, but I think he was being a little bit ironic and kind of throwing it back at, well, I mean, Goebbels had kind of a verve about him, I think, you know. But generally speaking, they didn't call themselves that. They were National Socialists. They were not. They had no reason to want to de-emphasize socialism. Socialism in Germany was a great selling point. It was not something of which to be embarrassed. You know, some of these right-wing patriotard people would like to remind people, Nazis are National Socialists.
Yes.
They are socialists. Okay.
Yes.
See, in American political rhetoric, that's quite damning. In Germany, it was a great selling point, not something that they'd want to minimize or hide. So they made a point. They wanted to call themselves National Socialists because that went over very well. Their enemies did not want that. They wanted to hide the fact that there was any such thing as an alternative form of socialism other than social democracy or communism. So they like that word Nazi.
And another thing I think people like to shorten, like I noticed always that Adolf Hitler never got tired of using the word National Socialist, and nor did others. But for a lot of people, that's a mouthful. They don't want to keep saying National Socialist. And even somebody like me might finally just start using the word Nazis, because that's what other people are using, just to shorten it, you know. Many say not to do that. That's a mistake.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen any original National Socialist source that used just Nazi.
No.
Closest I've seen is Goebbels. He wrote the Nazi Sozi. He makes sure to put the socialist part on there.
Yes. And the people, I think the people at that time took up that Nazi Sozi. But it wasn't official, and it's just because people like nicknames. And some people will say, well, Germans always have little short nicknames, and so they use that. There's nothing wrong with it. But officially, it was not used. And
yeah,
certainly
remember,
not just
I think
Nazi.
I read something recently that Nazi was some kind of Bavarian slang or something like that. It meant like a fool or something.
Oh.
Yeah, I just came back to me. I read that somewhere.
It's some kind of German slang. It had some kind of derogatory meaning.
Okay,
calling National Socialists Nazis is kind of like calling the Republicans repukes.
Yeah, there you go. Well, so since you've been doing that website for quite a while, you've got a lot on it. Anything else you want to say about that particular site before we go on to another one? Well, let's see.
I have a lot of translations on there that I did myself of stuff that is not available anywhere else in English.
That's wonderful. People really need to know that. They need to go there. I've linked to it in the announcement. I'll link to it in the on the program page. And people need to go there and see it. That's great that you taught yourself. You learned German, and so you can do all that. You did that at a young age. Now you mentioned economics, and you mentioned Lawrence Dennis. I don't know if you want to say anything about him, or if we've only got a half hour left, or if you want to move on.
Yeah, Lawrence Dennis is the American advocate of fascist economics. He wrote The Coming American Fascism, and he wrote another book that expresses his ideas more concisely, called The Dynamics of War and Revolution. The Coming American Fascism is available online. I even have that linked on my blog. And basically what Lawrence Dennis says is that because of the tendency of capitalism to produce more and more goods at less and less cost, and also because of, I mean, with less and less labor, actually, and also because of the loss of the frontier and the possibility to keep growing the population rapidly, capitalism was going to, as it had been practiced, was going to come to a crashing halt. There could not be, Well, it's because the whole thing is based on debt. See, when people borrow money and they on interest and they have to pay back more than they borrowed, some new wealth has to come in from somewhere.
Well, that creates the wealth, right?
And it's very hard to do that. They had a bubble developed during the 1920s that resulted in the crash in 1929. And then we had the same thing happen with the recent crash, with the overextension of credit. And it's basically what's happened is we've done away with somebody that's really keen on economics is going to tear me apart for saying this.
Well,
stuff. I really should have everything notes and everything.
Well, that's okay.
But anyway, Lawrence Dennis was an advocate of fascist economics. I think he's really good, and he ended up being one of the accused in the mass sedition trial during World War II.
Okay. Now, he was a mulatto. Who could pass for white until maybe he was found out or something. I don't know. Now, do you
think that
affected his thinking, his point of view, or did he think like a white man, or what?
Revelo Oliver has some interesting comments about Lawrence Dennis in that regard. He says that Lawrence Dennis seemed to be trying to prove all the time that he was smarter than everybody else. And if you had a little bit of Negro ancestry, you might be inclined to do that. You might have a little chip on your shoulder in regard to proving your intelligence.
Yes. So, but then in his attempts to prove it, did he really come up with a lot of good stuff?
I think what he writes is for the most part very sound. His father.
Yeah. Well, I know a lot of people think very highly of him.
Yeah, his father was a prominent, I believe, Atlanta attorney. And he was his father was a white man. And Lawrence Dennis passed for white, except when he went to Europe. When he went to Europe, people thought, this guy looks like an Arab or something, you know. But in the United States, you know, when you're comparing him to, you know, coal black black people, he could pass for white.
Yes. Yeah, I've seen pictures of him, and I thought that's how it was. He didn't look that white, but if you're not thinking about it, you know, if you just – then it could be. Well, okay. Now, the next website was this Setting the Record Straight that, that Will brought up. And that is actually at, as I said, non-counterproductive.blogspot.com. It's been going on since, what, 2010? It's pretty interesting. And you right now you've got some stuff on Harold Covington there. What would you like to say about that? You know, I mean, there's probably a lot you've gone into. You're trying to did you start it because people were telling lies about you, and so you thought you'd set the record straight, or are you just trying to set the record straight for everybody?
No, it didn't. It really had very little to do with me personally. I had heard about Covington after I joined the National Alliance because he was defaming a lot of people around that time. Will Williams was like one of his biggest targets. Also, somebody else that I knew was smeared in one of his newsletters. And Will Williams sued Harold Covington in the mid-late 1990s and got a big libel judgment against him. Covington gave a letter to the sent a statement to the court saying that since Will Williams was a white supremacist, he had no character to defame, therefore he couldn't be liable for defamation of character.
Okay, to not defame Will Williams myself, let me just say here, I'm still looking at this email. You know, I was trying to be in a hurry, and I went right to the where he said, please ask Hadding. But before that, here's what he said. You know, he's saying some that you were just a normal person, you know, sincere and serious. And imagine that. He says, not at all like claims we read on the Internet that he is a Cass Sunstein cognitive dissonance operative. So what he's saying is that you're not that, but people have claimed that you are. Then he asked to ask you why people who are supposedly on our side, like Covington or whoever, would make such a serious, unsubstantiated claim like that and expect to be believed. So.
Yeah, well, they're crazy people out there.
Well, they are. They're people who just they thrive on this type of.
You can't tell. See, I might have everybody hypnotized here.
Well, you know, but then
maybe
I've done my share of for the little time I've been in this, I've done my share what I call exposing people. But I think that where I go, what I go after needs to be. I can be accused of that myself, but I try to do it in a reasonable way and have plenty of evidence. I don't just call people things.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so I knew about Covington from when I was in the National Alliance in the 90s. And I heard some things about him also more recently. But my main inclination was to just ignore him and try to tell other people that they should ignore him, too. If I saw anything that he said that I recognized as a lie, I would tell people about it. Mostly, I just didn't want to pay any attention to him. Then in the summer of 2010, I was collaborating to some extent with Jim Giles. He made me the super moderator of his forum when he was doing his podcast regularly. And that brought me into a conflict because Jim Giles was taking very seriously this thing called A Brief History of the White Nationalist Movement, which was very obviously written by Harold Covington. I mean, Covington says he didn't write it. Oh, baloney. It's obviously written by Harold Covington because it's full of Harold Covington's traditional lies.
Okay. You know, so this history of the white movement was to point out who were the bad guys and who were the good guys, huh?
Well, yeah, it's full of all kinds of little scurrilous snickering rumors. And so-and-so is a homosexual. So-and-so, you know... got charged with all kinds of stuff that when you track it down, you'd find. I mean, there are a few things in there that are true. No, I mean, I can't say, you know, because that's usually what the Covingtonistas will do. They'll point to the one statement out of the 100 that's true and say, well, you're not going to say this is a lie, are you? Well, no, that one is true. Okay. You know, but it's a bunch of lies. But
See, Giles was taking this thing seriously and at face value and reading from it on his podcast, and he put it on the front page of his forum, and that brought me into conflict with Giles over the thing, and I also started debunking it because it was basically being put in my face. I think the first thing I wrote a little bit of a debunk about the section on Ben Klassen, and then something about Matt Cale. And then Giles he banned me from his forum because I wasn't going along with stuff anymore. And so I talked to Will Williams. I asked him if he'd toss a few nickels my way if I started a blog where I took apart this stuff. Because he'd been trying for years to neutralize Covington. You know, he'd gotten a big libel, a big judgment against Harold Covington, but he couldn't ever collect on it.
Yes, I read about that.
Covington left North Carolina, and with a contempt of court judgment hanging over his head. Actually, if he goes back, if Covington goes back to North Carolina, he'll spend 30 days in prison for contempt of court. So after I had my face rubbed in this thing that Covington wrote, I had sort of halfway started on debunking it. I got some donations to encourage me to keep doing that. So I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
How do you feel about what should be done in amongst all pro-white people when they have these big arguments and really nasty things are said and lies are spoken, or one thing or another, or you think certain people are going in a very wrong direction? Or you started a blog. I've talked about things on my radio programs that other people wouldn't have never did, you know, or. So do you think that's a good idea? If some people think that's wrong, we should all somehow keep our, like, don't air your dirty laundry and just try to do all this stuff.
Well, in general, I think that's, I don't like to talk about people's personal situations, you know, unless they themselves make it into a public issue.
If it's not just I understand that.
The thing is with Covington, He puts out dirty laundry that isn't even authentic. He puts out other people's dirty laundry, and it's not even real dirty laundry that belongs to them.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying.
So therefore, that's something
lies.
That ought to be addressed.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Otherwise, that becomes the canonical version of history.
Yeah. Right. I mean, there's a thing about truth. I mean, does everybody in the white movement, are they all after truth, or are they only the kind of truth they want to present? So, yeah, you can't be a fanatic about truth. I understand that. You just can't go, this little tiny thing is not true. We got to clean this up. But
my focus on the blog, on that blog, was on Covington's statements.
Yes. I think that's very fair.
On his statements and ask, is this a true statement? Can I find any evidence for it, or is it contradicted by evidence? And not just attack him personally. As a matter of fact, I heard Covington complain about that, or maybe I wrote where I read where he complained about it, where he talked about how past attacks on himself had been in the matter of somebody dumping a bucket of slime over his head. And that he could get past that, but that what I was doing was much more insidious.
Well, see now, we've got 15 minutes left, less than that. And see, as I said, we never have enough time. There's somehow the way it works out, there's never enough time. So let me say now, just real quick about your William Pierce, Legacy of William Pierce blog. And you do that with Will Williams, I think. And,
Will Williams actually does most of the work on it. He has a couple of fellows that help him with it as far as taking printed documents and converting them into text. One of them is Smoky Mountain over on the VNN forum. Does a lot of work for it.
Okay. Well, I think that's great. And it's not That started in 2011, so it's not that old, but it's got some good stuff on there. I read that comic book last night. I had never seen that before. So, there's just so much material. But that's a place people can go, and it's like just what it says. It's trying to preserve the legacy of William Pierce and make everything available. And you asked the question on there, do you know of anything or have anything that has never, by him or about him that hasn't been published, send it to us and so on. Now, you recently had an article at Occidental Observer. It was called Our Weapon, the Truth. It was a little while ago, but you got some high fives for that. And I don't really want to go into the article. People can go there and read it. Occidental Observer, Our Weapon, the Truth by Hadding Scott. There are a lot of comments, and I want to mention a couple of comments that were there that bring up some things. And I'm going to go to one by Ward Kendall. He says, after he says quite a few things, I'm not sure what he's critical of, or he's a little bit critical of William Pierce for not.
Yeah, he always was.
Yeah,
he
always was. He's a little critical. But then he says, after he says why William Pierce didn't get the job done and how he didn't and so on, he says, compare, if you would, the modern nascent efforts of Dr. Tom Sunick, Dr. Kevin McDonnell, Dr. Greg Johnson, Dr. Mark Weber, Dr. Michael O'Meara, Dr. Guillaume Thai, along with such new right thinkers as Kurtagic and Spencer and James Edwards, and compare them to this reclusive Bill Pierce and so on. Well, and the one thing I want to say that he should know that Mark Weber is not a doctor. And so many people. Now, here's one of these things where I think needs to be corrected. Because when somebody puts something out like that, and maybe he did it because he wanted to put him together with these people, or maybe he thinks that, because a lot of people think that Mark Weber has a PhD. But I don't think he himself has ever proclaimed that. But he doesn't. Now, as far as Greg Johnson goes, I'm sure he does have one. He says he has. I mean, it says on there that he's a PhD, but he has never said where he got that PhD. And I find that kind of strange. And if I'm wrong, somebody should correct me and tell me where he got his PhD. But I wonder if that's one of those things that's not being said. And then another comment there is that from Sam Davidson. And he starts out, he says, great post, Hadding. Then he says, I'm going to repeat what Greg Johnson said. To tell anything less than the whole truth is a lie. Now I'm not trying to go after Greg Johnson, but you know what I've had on some of my recent Heretics Hour programs. But, Greg Johnson obviously said this, to tell anything less than the whole truth is a lie. And I think we need to hold these people accountable for some of this. And certainly he hasn't even told us the whole truth about his PhD. Has he? Do you have any comment on that?
Well, a lot of people that will say that you have to tell the truth all the time and say it very ostentatiously are offenders against the very thing that they're saying. Johnson would not be the only example.
Well, that's true. That's true. I really don't want to pick on Greg Johnson, but it sounds like I am. But I noticed that. I would like him to give that information out. And then on going to Mark Weber, we don't have too much time, but since I got to this place, unless you really want to say something about Bill White, I don't know if we want to get into that or not, then I don't think so. The news.
Poor Bill White. The guy,
Yeah. Well,
I don't want to pick on it. He's got enough troubles. He's not going to be a problem for anybody for a long time.
No, well, I agree. I think he makes his own. He creates his problems. I just don't understand why he does the things he does. But anyway, let's go to back to your. Now, which one was it? National Socialist Worldview, and you do have scrolling down some. You have a blog on. It's called Mark Weber is a plagiarist. Is that it?
Or yes.
Weber the plagiarist. And I, We don't have too much time to get into this, but would you like to explain a little bit what you mean by that? Because I think it kind of fits.
I noticed that he had an article on his on the IHR site where he used a couple of findings that I had published on my blog in regard to I don't even remember off the top of my head what it was. But I wrote to him three times saying, would you at least put a link to my blog where I talk about these things? And he wouldn't do it. So, I mean, that was the only way I could fight him, was to say, look, this is what Mark Weber did.
And see, here is Mark Weber, plagiarist. Mark Weber never comes up and is not a researcher, it doesn't seem to me, except in other people's books. I mean, yeah, Mark Weber does things where he redoes what other historians have written. He doesn't come up with new concepts or new ideas I'm not probably saying that right because I haven't prepared this. But he has, he's got a reputation, I think, that is beyond what it should be, because he's very good at presenting information that's already been published by someone, organizing it and making it clear to people to read it, to understand it. But he doesn't initiate any new work. So he's not a revisionist. He's not even much of a historical revisionist.
Well, he's the worst thing about Mark Weber is that he's backed off from saying that there was no Holocaust.
Well, right. I'm kind of going around that, because some people say, well, that's past. So what? He's doing all this good work now.
He's not just talking about other things. If he just talked about other things, then I wouldn't have so much of a criticism. But he still does talk about the Holocaust sometimes. But he says basically that it happened.
Yes.
He says millions of Jews were killed. He said that. Where does he get this? Faurisson wrote about that a few years ago. He says, where does Weber get this, that millions of Jews were killed? And not that, but Weber uses the Goebbels diaries as a source. When Weber himself in 1988 testified in Ernst Zundel's trial in Toronto that the Goebbels diaries were probably fake because they had inconsistencies in relation to reality and there were other reasons to doubt their authenticity. But now he uses them as if they were a good source.
Yeah, and he's also said that he considers himself a Holocaust revisionist. But what he won't, when you try to put him on the spot, he's very evasive. He's always been that way. He's very evasive as to actually saying that it's this or it's that. And he feels safe saying that it's that a million Jews were murdered and
millions.
They suffered terribly. Yeah, millions. That's right. Not just a million, millions. These people are not being, they get away with it. And not only that, they collect a lot of money. And if somebody says, well, I don't care about the Holocaust anyway, it's good what he's doing. All he's doing is maintaining a website that was already there pretty much as it is now when he took over. Right? It's not new material.
Yeah. I saw a statement that was put out by Dr. Faurisson recently. He said, look, I'm old. I have limited time. Even in each day, I have not enough time to do everything that needs to be done. Meanwhile, the Jews are putting out these gigantic new books to continue to perpetuate their myth. Somebody has to address all this stuff. The one that should be doing it is Mark Weber and the Institute for Historical Review. He should be doing that.
Excellent. Excellent. That's right. That's why it's justified to criticize what he's doing or what he's not doing, because that institute was set up to combat Holocaustianity, and it was doing a great job in the 80s, And then when this whole thing, which we don't have time to discuss, but came up with the lawsuit against Willis Carto, because Carto wanted to include, he just wanted to include historical revisionism with Holocaust revisionism, and the revisionists didn't like that, but some people say there's more to it than that. But it was basically about money and where the money was going, who was getting the money. But it ended up with Mark Weber in control with his board of directors, and since then, everything has really stopped as far as
Holocaust revisionism,
but even the historical revisionism. There's nothing new going on there, except with maybe David Irving.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that he's liable to answer for that, but he doesn't answer. But where that's going, I don't know. But I did want to actually be able to talk about that a little bit more, but then I couldn't resist bringing it up. So maybe another time.
Okay.
You don't want to say any more. Well, you made it very clear that everything stopped. And this is what I kind of intimated earlier, that, yes, with Pierce and so on, that the things are going very strongly, and then somehow they're brought to an end or difficulties.
Well, you know,
and there's usually
Moses
somebody involved, you know.
And what happened when Moses went away to the mountain, right? They start worshiping the golden calf, right?
Yeah.
Well, this time Moses went away and didn't come back.
Yeah.
And it's the same kind of thing when Odysseus was away for 20 years at the Trojan War. He comes back and his house is full of all these suitors that are eating and drinking and...
Well, there's a...
He has to kill off a bunch of them to reestablish the way things ought to be.
Yeah, that's to try to hold a clear line. Look at even Hitler's National Socialist Third Reich. I mean, it got taken down, too. I mean, nothing good that is set up seems to last. And I think it is the same culprits who are infiltrating. And so I think infiltration, and you don't want to be accusing people all over the place, you know. I mean, you have to have some sense about it, because I've just recently experienced some people accusing someone with based on nothing except the way they interpret things. But, you know,
yeah, well, see, I don't so much worry about infiltration. It's more just foolishness. People go for the obvious instead of thinking a little more deeply.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Well, ladies and gentlemen, and Hadding, we are coming. We've got less than a minute to go. And Hadding, I want to thank you so much. You were a wonderful guest, as you were always a wonderful caller. Yes, you were. Do you have any parting words in 30 seconds? You don't have to. Put you on the spot.
I just want to say thank you very much for recommending the Dr. William Pierce blogspot. And remember to emphasize quality over quantity. Build the cadre.
All right.
Don't go for the mass appeal.
All right. Don't go for the mass appeal. I agree with that. I really do. And so thank you. Thank you, listeners. Hope you enjoyed this show. Come back again next Saturday afternoon. This is Carolyn Yeager.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyeager.com.